Now really turn to John chapter 18. Remember, we're looking at the crucifixion right now in John 18 and 19. And we noted that the crucifixion is preceded by the arrest and the trials of Jesus. And we looked at the arrest of Jesus. And last time we looked at some of the trials. And we noted that there are six different trials that Jesus goes through or undergoes, not necessarily formal trials, but illegal trials. Remember, he was tried first before Annas. Annas was the former high priest of Israel. He was not the high priest, but he had the power. He was the man with the power in Israel. And his decision when they came to him with Jesus was, go ahead, get rid of him. Give him the death sentence. Then he was tried before Caiaphas, who was the high priest, at Caiaphas's trial, and that's in Matthew. The decision was, again, death sentence. Charge was blasphemy. Now that's important. The charge was blasphemy. And then the third religious trial was before the Sanhedrin. Look over in Matthew 26. This isn't recorded in John's Gospel, but in Matthew chapter 26, starting about verse 57, it says, those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. But Peter was following him at a distance, and so on and so forth. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so they might put him to death. So before Caiaphas, they're trying to put him to death. And then down in chapter 27 and verse 1 and 2, it says, now when morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people conferred together against Jesus to put him to death. So that was the third religious trial before the Sanhedrin. That was all the big shots of Israel got together and they decided to put him to death. So they bound him and they led him away and delivered him to Pilate, the governor. So the religious trials were before Annas, the man with the power, and then Caiaphas, the man with the title, he had the high priest, and then in the morning before the whole Sanhedrin. Now, civil trials is what we're going to look at this evening. The first civil trial will be before Pilate. And the second, before Herod. Now, again, John does not record the trial before Herod, but we'll go over and read it in Luke. The trial before Pilate, the decision in the first trial here was not guilty. I find no guilt in this man. And we'll see that this evening. And then in the second trial, Herod, his decision was, I don't want anything to do with this. It's a hot potato. Send him back to Pilate. So he sends him back to Pilate. And then there's the third civil trial before Pilate. And the decision for this trial is not guilty. Crucify him anyway. So he was crucified on a verdict of not guilty. Because Pilate says again, I find no guilt in this man. And we'll see tonight that Pilate keeps trying to get Jesus off the hook. He does everything in his power to get Jesus off the hook. Now there are several reasons for that, or supposed reasons. His wife had a dream, and we'll look at that. Let's just proceed on and we'll get to it when we get to it. But just reading John's Gospel, we have to be aware of what John is looking at. And this is important, so I've prefaced every class with it, because there are four major points that John is trying to make about these trials and about the crucifixion. And that's why John chooses to include some events and not others, because he is trying to make some points here. And the first one is the voluntary nature of Jesus' suffering. In chapter 18, verse 4, it says, "So Jesus, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth and said, 'Whom do you seek?'" So he knew what was going to happen, and he went forth. It was voluntary. They didn't have to come and find him. He went forth. And then down in verse 11, it says, "So Jesus said to Peter, 'Put the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?'" So he doesn't take help from anybody. He says, no assistance. This has to be what it has to be, and it's completely voluntary. He also is going to stress the fulfillment of divine plan in the suffering of Jesus. That's in chapter 19 and verse 11, where it says, "Jesus answered, 'You would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin.'" So this is a fulfillment of divine plan. He says, you couldn't have done this if the authority hadn't been given to you. Fulfillment of Scripture, 18:8 says, "Jesus answered, 'I told you that I am. So if you seek me, let these go their way.'" And talking about being the voluntary nature of his suffering, he's the one who tells them who they can arrest and who they can't. Here he tells them to let his disciples go their way. Well, Peter had just lopped a guy's ear off. I mean, that you would think they would want to arrest him too, but they don't. They let him go because Jesus is in control. And then in verse 9 it says, "To fulfill the word which he spoke, 'Of those whom you have given me, I lost not one.'" And then the final thing that John is very adamantly stressing in this section is the dignity and the majesty of Jesus in his suffering. He never, ever loses his cool. He's always dignified. He's always majestic. He's always godly. Well, he is God. So that shouldn't surprise us. Look at verse 6. When they approached him, "So when he said to them, 'I am,'" and the he isn't in there, he just said, "I am." And what happened? "They drew back and fell to the ground." So he's very dignified. He's in complete control of the situation. He knows what's going to have to happen, and yet he does it anyway. That's John's point here. Now, we looked at the trial before Annas last time. And the thing we noted about that trial was that it was absolutely illegal. There was nothing legal about bringing Jesus before Annas. Because first in verse 14 of chapter 18, it says, "Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people." And he had decided that before all of this came about. So before any of the trials, the outcome was predetermined. They knew what they were going to do. The trials were just a means to an end, a means to get rid of Jesus. The proceedings were at night. Well, first, the judge couldn't initiate the charges. It was against their law for a judge to initiate the charge. Just like we don't. The judge doesn't initiate the charge. It's the district attorney that does that. So they had that same thing. But in Mark chapter 14, verse 61, it says, "But he kept silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him and saying to him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?'" So he's bringing the charge, the high priest. The indictment was supposed to be stated at the trial. It never was before the Jewish trials. And in fact, the indictment changed. As we noted last week, that in Jewish court, when they had Jesus in front of the Jews, they charged him with blasphemy. Then we're going to see tonight when they go over to the Roman court, Pilate's going to say, "What did this guy do?" That puts the Jews kind of in the hot seat because they don't care. I mean, the Romans don't care if he blasphemed the Jewish God. What's it to them? So they didn't have anything that they could use against him at a Roman trial. So they changed the charge from blasphemy to sedition, or being a revolutionary. So right in the middle of the stream here, between one trial and the next, they changed the charge. That's completely illegal. All of this was completely illegal, and they struck him, remember? That was illegal. It was illegal to strike a prisoner before he was found guilty. So all of these things, going into the trial before Pilate now, they had just done all of these illegal things, and now we get to the civil trial. And the civil trial will take us from John 18:28 to 19:16. And the first thing we'll look at is Jesus delivered over to Pilate in verse 28 through 32. So let's read those. Starting at verse 28, it says, "Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the Praetorium. And it was early, and they themselves did not enter into the Praetorium, so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Therefore Pilate went out to them, and said, 'What accusation do you bring against this man?' They answered and said to him, 'If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you.' So Pilate said to them, 'Take him yourselves, and judge him according to your law.' The Jews said to him, 'We are not permitted to put anyone to death, to fulfill the words of Jesus which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die.' Therefore Pilate entered again into the Praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, 'Are you the King of the Jews?'" Okay, so first we notice that John doesn't cover what happened to Jesus before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. In verse 28, he goes straight from Caiaphas to the Praetorium, to Pilate. And we read those sections earlier that fill in the blanks there about what happened before Caiaphas and what happened before the Sanhedrin. Caiaphas charged him and found him guilty of blasphemy, and the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling authority, kind of put the official stamp on that charge. They said, yes, he's guilty. Let's get rid of him. So now here they are before the Romans, and they deliver him over to Pilate. The Praetorium, by the way, is the official residence of the Roman governor. Now, normally Pilate would have been in Caesarea. That's where he lived. That was down on the coast in a much nicer place. But during the Passover week, he always came up to Jerusalem, and he brought some extra troops with him. And he had a reason for doing this. It was because during this week, the Passover week, was when Jewish nationalism was at its peak. The Jews were very nationalistic. This was their big holy day, the Passover. And it's kind of a tense time for the Romans, because if they were going to do something, it probably would have been during that time, because they had a lot of extra men in town, and they were really pumped up for the Passover. So you can see why the Romans were a little bit skittish about this week. So what Pilate did is he came up from Caesarea and brought some extra troops with him just in case there was going to be trouble. And I said this before, if this wasn't such a terribly sad and terribly, I don't know, unfair ordeal, we could almost find humor in it. And I think John saw the irony of the situation when he wrote this down. But John had a very subtle sense of humor. So what he says is, in verse 28, "Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the Praetorium. And it was early, and they themselves did not enter into the Praetorium, so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover." Now, if the Jews had entered the courtyard of Pilate, they would have incurred ceremonial defilement for 7 days. Now, the dwelling places of Gentiles were considered to be unclean. Ceremonially unclean. Didn't mean they had dust bunnies, but it meant they were ceremonially unclean. So if a Jew were to enter a Gentile's house, he would be ceremonially unclean for 7 days. So they couldn't go into the Praetorium, or they wouldn't be able to participate in the Passover. So now they could have a clear conscience while they're crucifying God. You see the irony in the situation? I mean, these people are completely legalistic. All they think of is, I can't step in that house. It's a Gentile house. And yet they're plotting to kill the Son of God. I think John had kind of a sense of the irony of this when he wrote this down. Now, in verse 29, we get to the legal action. In verse 29, it says, therefore, Pilate went out to them, so he accommodated their religious rules that they couldn't enter a Gentile's house. So he went out to them and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? Now, Pilate's question here doesn't imply that he didn't know what they're up to, because we'll see that he did. He had prior conversations with the Jews, and that becomes apparent when he interviews Jesus. But what his question means is that he's following procedure. He's asking them, what formal charge are you bringing against this man? So he's asking for a charge. Now that brings up a dilemma for the Jews. They don't have a charge that would stand up in a Roman court. Like I said before, blasphemy of the God of the Jews meant nothing to Pilate. He didn't care. So they had no charge that would hold up in a Roman court, and they were not allowed to execute capital punishment cases without a Roman court. So they're kind of between a rock and a hard space here. Now the Romans had a reason for this. They had a reason for not allowing capital punishment in one of their territories. And that was because when they conquered a territory, they were very lenient with the people there. They let them almost self-govern, like the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin met and made decisions just like it had before Rome took over. But they wouldn't allow them to execute capital punishment. Why was that? Well, it was because they were afraid that some revolutionaries might get together and take everybody that was loyal to the Romans and kind of, you know, trump up a charge and execute them so that they could rebel against Rome. And that's why Rome had this law in place that if they wanted to execute somebody, then they had to come to the Roman governor and he had to try the case to make sure that it was valid and that it wasn't just something they were trumping up to get rid of Roman sympathizers. Now the Jews' reply in verse 30 is kind of interesting. It says, they answered and said to him, if this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you. There's a great answer, isn't it? What's the formal charge you have against this man? He's not nice. He's an evildoer. Actually, it's two words in Greek. Normally, we say this word in Greek is seven words in English, but this time it goes the other way. He's an evil doer, a doer of evil. And the word doer here in the Greek is a present active participle. And that means a continuous action. We would call that a habitual criminal. Now, if you're familiar with the justice system, from either side, you know that we have the expression habitual criminal, or a habit is the nickname for it. And we have two kinds. There's a big habit and a little habit. Have you ever heard that before? Maybe I ran in crowds that you guys probably didn't when I was younger. But a big habit was a habitual felon, and a little habit was a habitual misdemeanor, you know, petty crime type guy. But that's what they were saying Jesus was. He's a habitual criminal. He's always causing trouble. That implies that Pilate should just take their word for it and say, okay, you can crucify him then. Or you can kill him then. But that can't happen. Why? What was the Jewish method of execution? was stoning. It wasn't crucifixion. So it had to take place through the Roman system. That's why it's going through the Roman system, although these guys don't know that. That's why God had it worked out this way. In verse 31, Pilate answers, and he says basically, well, if this guy is a habitual criminal under your laws, why don't you take care of it? You know, you have a Sanhedrin. You have the resources to deal with criminals. It says in verse 31, so Pilate said to them, take him yourselves. Judge him according to your law. But then the Jews answered back and said to him, we are not permitted to put anyone to death. So the admission of the Jews that they were not permitted to put anyone to death is a statement of their intentions. And they want him dead. That's what they want. They don't want to take care of him with their own legal system, because if they did that, they'd have to mete out a punishment something less than the death penalty. So they couldn't have that. So both the fact of Jesus' death and the method are important. As I said, the Jewish form of execution was stoning. The Romans crucified. So Jesus had to be put to death by the Romans. Look at Deuteronomy 21. In Deuteronomy 21, verse 22 and 23, we see why he has to be put to death under the Roman system. And this ties in with Galatians too, as you'll recall. In verse 22, it says, if a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his corpse shall not hang all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day. For he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. And remember, it says in Galatians, I believe, that anyone who hangs on a tree is cursed. So that's why he had to die that method of execution. So both the fact of his death and the method of his death are important. He also prophesied, look at John 12. In John 12, verse 32 and 33, it says, and I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. But he was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he was to die. So they knew what that meant. I am lifted up from the earth. He meant he was to be crucified. So important that he is crucified. It's important that he went through the Roman system as well as the Jewish system. Now, Pilate takes Jesus now and interviews him in verse 33 through 40. Verse 33 says, therefore Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? This question shows that Pilate already knew what was up, doesn't it? Because he knew what the charge was. You're saying you're the king of the Jews. That's not what they said outside, remember? They said, well, he's a habitual criminal, so you should put him to death. So when he brings him inside, he said, so you're the one they're accusing of being king of the Jews? So he knew what was going on. In all four of the Gospels, this is recorded as the first question that Pilate asks him. And in all four of the Gospels, the word you is emphatic, very emphatic in the Greek. So Pilate's saying, you're the one they accuse of being king of the Jews? Well, you don't look like any king I ever saw. That's kind of the idea behind that, being emphatic. He's incredulous. You're the guy that says he's king of the Jews? Now, Jesus' reply, and his reply irritates Pilate. He was not used to having his questions challenged. But look at verse 34. It says, Jesus answered, are you saying this on your own initiative, Or did others tell you about me? Now, Pilate is about to admit that he was told. Well, he doesn't have to admit it. Jesus knows, of course. You know, Jesus' answer, he didn't do this just to irritate Pilate. He says, are you speaking on your own initiative, or did somebody else put you up to this? The reason he asked that question, because his answer would have been different depending on the answer to that question. Because if Pilate were speaking for himself, the question would be, are you a political king that is opposed to Caesar? That would have been Pilate's question. That's what he was interested in. But if it was the Jews he was speaking for, the question would have been, are you the messianic king of Israel? And to that question, Jesus would answer yes. To the first one, he would say no. I'm not a political king that is challenging the Roman Empire. But if Pilate was speaking for the Jews, are you the king of Israel? Then he would have said, yes, I am the messianic king. So he's not just trying to irritate Pilate or get his goat. He asked that question so he could know what answer he should give. So Pilate gets irritated. In verse 35, Pilate answered, I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priest delivered you to me. What have you done? His answer is just full of contempt for the Jews. You can see it. I mean, it's not in there, but you can read it in, I'm not a stinking Jew, am I? Why should I know? So he says, your own nation and chief priest delivered you to me. What have you done? He's kind of convinced that there's more to this charge than meets the eye. And that's kind of obvious, isn't it? Well, he's a bad guy. What kind of a charge is that? He's an evildoer. So he's convinced that there's something behind that. So he asked Jesus flat out, what did you do? Now, he doesn't accept the charges of the high priest at face value. So Pilate wasn't just going to give a rubber stamp on this. He wanted to know what behind it. What was important to him was what Jesus had done. Why? Well, is it against Roman law or not? That's what he wanted to find out. So there again, if he was going to give them permission to execute this man, he needed a charge that was against Roman law. So Jesus answers, he admits that he, in a sense, he has a kingdom. But he kind of stresses the fact that his kingdom is not a kingdom as the world understands it. That's not the kind of a kingdom he's talking about. Not a kingdom that's going to be attacking Rome, say, for example. In fact, the word of, it says, Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. The word of in the Greek is a little preposition ek, and it's a very important little preposition. It means out of as a source. Out of as a source. So what he's saying is that the source of his kingdom is not this world system. He is not saying, and some people take this verse out of context, and they'll say, well, Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. That means that the millennial kingdom is just an allegory. It's not real. That has nothing to do with this context. That you have to take that verse completely out of its context to get that from it. What he's saying is that his kingdom doesn't find its source in this world system. He points out that his followers aren't engaged in any military activities. Now, if he'd been interested in what this world calls a kingdom, what would have been his first step? We need an army if we're going to have a kingdom, or, you know, Rome is going to trample us in no time at all. So he points that out to them. He says, if my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. So his kingdom is not what we would call a kingdom, or what Pilate would call a kingdom. It's not a worldly kind of kingdom. Pilate's response then, in verse 37, therefore Pilate said to him, so you are a king. And again, the you is emphatic. So you are a king? And again, you don't look like one. I mean, you don't look like a king at all. And Jesus' answer to him is a little bit hard to translate into English. We could paraphrase it this way. I didn't say that. I didn't say that I was a king. But since you put it that way, I can't deny it. So he's kind of hedging a little here. He's saying, I didn't say that really I'm a king in the sense that you think. But I am a king. So he can't deny that fact. What he's trying to get across here is the difference between what Pilate would consider to be a king and what Jesus would consider to be a king. So he's trying to get that difference across. And he's saying, well, verse 37, Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. So Jesus is more interested in reaching Pilate with the truth than he is really in defending himself. So he says, yeah, you say I'm a king. That's true in a sense. But I'm here basically to proclaim truth. Now that's a common denominator in Jesus when he's talking to somebody. Remember Nicodemus, the woman at the well? He always turns it around to be more of a proclamation of truth than a conversation. When the woman asks about the water, he says, well, I can give you a spring of water that'll never run dry. And of course, she took it to be a physical spring of water. And, oh, this is great. I won't have to come to the well anymore. But he, of course, he was talking spiritual things, and she was talking of physical things. The same is true of Nicodemus, and the same here. So he's trying to reach Pilate. So Pilate now, he is convinced that the kingdom that Jesus is talking about is not an earthly kind of kingdom, and that he is innocent then of being a revolutionary. He has no designs on revolting against the Roman Empire. And Pilate sees that. So his response to Jesus, in verse 38, Pilate said to him, what is truth? That's the question you hear all the time, isn't it? What is truth? How can you determine what truth is? He's not asking Jesus to tell him what is truth. What he's doing is he's dismissing the subject. What is truth? That means he's done talking. So he goes outside again. And he tells the Jews in no uncertain terms here that he finds no reason to put this man to death. Verse 38, it says, and when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, I find no guilt in him. And those words, I find no guilt in him, are very emphatic. And what it does is it sets Pilate in contrast to the Jewish leaders, because they want him put to death. He says, I can't find any reason for it. The word no, when it says I find no guilt in him, that's also emphatic. It means not even a little bit. None at all. There's no guilt at all in this guy, and I can't find any reason to put him to death. So now what happens, and John doesn't record this, but Luke does. So look at Luke 23. Luke chapter 23 and verse 4. In verse 4, we find out that we're in the same spot in the story, because it says, Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. And that's where we left up over in John. Now Luke inserts a story that isn't in John's gospel. And remember, I told you before, the reason that the gospels, some tell some parts of the story and some tell other parts, is that each of the authors of the gospel had his own special purpose in writing this account. He was trying to emphasize certain things. Now, John didn't consider this necessary for what he was emphasizing, so he didn't record it. But Luke did. Of course, Luke, being a historian, is the one who records the historical account the best. In verse 4, it says, Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. But they kept on insisting, saying, He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place. Now Pilate picks up on that. When Pilate heard it, he asked whether this man was a Galilean. So he picked up on that word Galilee. Now this, in his mind, gives him a chance to dodge the responsibility, because he doesn't want it. He doesn't want to put Jesus to death. So he sends Jesus over to Herod. Herod was a tetrarch. And what a tetrarch was a ruler of one-fourth of a region. And he was the tetrarch of Galilee. Pilate was the ruler, the governor of the whole region, but the tetrarch was Herod. So he sent him over there. And what happens is, verse 7, And when he learned he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was in Jerusalem at the time. Now Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he had wanted to see him for a long time, because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. And he questioned him at some length, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing him vehemently. And Herod, with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. Now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day, for before they had been enemies with each other. So Herod, he just takes the whole thing as a joke, and they belittle Jesus and send him back to Pilate. So Herod wants no part of any question about treason against the Roman Empire. I mean, he wanted to talk to Jesus to see some magic tricks, but when it comes down to it, if this guy is charged with treason against the Roman Empire, that's a big deal. So he backs down and sends him back to Pilate. So Jesus is mocked and sent back to Pilate. Now Pilate examines Jesus again. Now we're down in John 18:33. And this is Pilate's next effort to save Jesus. And Pilate's going to try to get him off the hook. Or at least he's going to try to save himself from the shame of convicting someone he knows is innocent. I mean, they had some scruples in the Roman Empire, and their system of justice was noted for being just that, a system of justice. So he appeals to a Passover custom of releasing a prisoner from custody on the Passover. That was customary. In verse 39, it says, But you have a custom that I release someone for you at the Passover. Do you wish, then, that I release for you the King of the Jews? So he's trying again to get Jesus off the hook, or at least to pass the buck to somebody. Well, look over at Matthew 27:19, and this isn't recorded in John's Gospel, but it kind of gives us an idea what might be going through Pilate's mind. In Matthew 27:19, it says, While he was sitting on the judgment seat, that is Pilate, his wife sent him a message saying, Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him. So he had his wife send him a message that said, you better not mess with this guy because I had a dream about him last night. So that might be what's in Pilate's mind when he's trying to get Jesus off the hook. Or it may have just been a matter of justice to him. But he does everything in his power to free Jesus. But the crowd, they're adamant. No, we don't want anybody else. We want Jesus. Verse 40, so they cried out again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. So the crowd is adamant. These guys have been manipulated. They've been whipped into a frenzy. They want blood, and they want Jesus' blood and nobody else's. So when Pilate comes out and says, look, you got a custom that I release somebody from custody, why not this King of the Jews guy? But they won't have anything of it. So next time we'll pick up there then with the crown of thorns incident and begin chapter 19 of John. Father, thank you again for your word, and thank you for this record of the crucifixion of your son. We thank you that you sent your son into the world to become a man so that he could go through this terrible punishment and this incredible suffering that we can't even imagine, so that he could pay the penalty for our sins. And it's in his name we pray. Amen.